I'll give you an easy one. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? It's the egg. Eggs have been around for 340 million years or so, while the chicken first appeared at most 58,000 years ago. So it's the egg. Or if you want to look at it another way, when the first chicken appeared in the evolutionary timeline, the egg with that chicken in it was laid by something that was almost, but not quite, a chicken. So it's still the egg. I'm not an egg. The show isn't an egg. It's Depresh Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. Now we'll move on to a slightly harder question. Does someone have a hard time making friends because they deal with depression and anxiety? Or does someone deal with anxiety and depression because they have a hard time making friends? I got no answer on that one. But it might be a question that Gabe Malika has spent some time mulling over. Gabe is a comedian in New York, and he's the creator and star of an off-Broadway one-man show called Solo, a show about friendship. Gabe has, at various times, found himself without friends, albeit with bros, he'll explain, and also he's found himself depressed and anxious. I wanted you to hear his story because there's a lot in it about how we reach out to other people and why we reach out to other people and how that sometimes works out for us. Gabe Malika, welcome to Depresh Mode.
It's really, really exciting to be here. As I was telling you, John, I've been listening for a long time and to all different types of guests, so this is very cool to make an appearance.
Excellent. Well, thanks for listening. What is your show Solo about?
So the main premise is that I get on stage and I just say, I turned 30 and it occurred to me that I don't have friends. And it's a pretty jarring statement because, like, I'm pretty affable. And I think some people are like, get out of here. What are you talking about? You have friends in your life. You're nuts. And I kind of make the distinction between, like, I have friends and I have bros. Mm. And there's a distinction there in the sense of, like, these bros I've known since high school. And we hang out once a month. We order food. We watch movies. But we don't really talk about anything all that serious. And for a long time, that was, like, not a problem because life is hard and it's nice to have those people. And then I talk about how my mom got sick. And this was challenged a little bit. And her getting sick caused me to have a bit of a meltdown, which I describe in the show. And the meltdown kind of started me to analyze these friendships a little bit. And then I go, the main arc of the show is I talk about a big friendship breakup in my early 20s and how, like, I used to have a person that I thought was this kind of, like, rock steady kind of relationship in my life, and that imploded in my early 20s. And so the show is kind of those two ingredients.
Hmm. How was the show born?
You know, I went through this friendship breakup in my early 20s, and I kind of immediately knew, because I started comedy right after and started listening to comedy podcasts right after, like, this is my origin story. Like, this is, like, how, this is my The Big Sick or Crashing or whatever it is. This is, like, how I got into comedy. And truth be told, I was living in Scotland when this friendship breakup happened, and I just bought notebooks and started sitting in coffee shops all day. And finally, I had something to do to occupy my brain. Like, I had never drank coffee before. I'd never really been creative or put time aside to be creative. And suddenly my days were flying by because I had these goals, which is I'm going to write and then talk about my thoughts.
What were you doing in Scotland?
I had a teaching fellowship. It was an exchange program where a graduate of my college would go to Scotland for a year at a prep school, and a graduate of this prep school would come to my college for a year and go and have, like, a freshman year of college. And so I got this fellowship, mostly because I just had experience working with kids. It was not because I was the smartest or the brightest. It was, they were just like, you actually like kids and volunteer with children. Like, you should have this. Okay. And so it was a fun year. I was the varsity basketball coach.
Wow.
And I helped in music class. Yeah, they were just like, you're American, you know basketball. And I was like, I talk in the show, I'm like, I'm terrible at sports. But they just needed someone to do it. And so I kind of just did a lot of different things. And about halfway through this year, it's like a tale as old as time, right? My best friend and my girlfriend fell in love.
Mm.
And that was about, like, the halfway point. And so it was a miserable first half of the year because I kind of could sense that it was happening. And then the second half of the year in Scotland was just me dealing with that. And so it was not the best year of my life. It was a pretty informative year, to be honest. It made me miss New York. It made me miss my people. But it really did change the trajectory of my whole life. I think had I not had that, it would have been trouble.
So the breakup with your friend, was that happening after your mom was sick?
Yeah, the big friendship breakup is from my early 20s.
Okay.
And that's like the my mom getting sick was, I'm 31 now. That was when I was 30. So that's like more recent.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's introduce the characters in this friendship breakup, because I think it's important. Tell me about, I believe your friend's name is Tim.
Yeah, his name is Tim. And we met in college. We met in poetry class. And he was just kind of this really brilliant, smart, kind person. And the first time we hung out, we were walking across campus, and I was like, oh, like, I gotta go leave, I gotta go sing with my accompanist. And I'll never forget Tim being like, oh, like, can I come hear you sing? And that was just very counter to my bro experience in high school. Like, none of the bros were like really interested at all in my creative musical life. And so the fact that this guy would want to come to my music lesson was like nuts to me. I was like, who is this guy that wants to like share in all the parts of my life? And since then, or the rest of college, we were really, really close, right? We took like a million classes together. We lived together. We volunteered together. We did the Big Brothers Big Sisters program. So we like adopted a kid together.
Wow.
to be like this kid's uncles. And we'd take him to concerts and bowling and stuff like that. So it was like a pretty unusual, I would say, friendship, in the sense that it just felt very, very close to me. And then we got even closer when he brought me to this summer camp for kids with illnesses, this Paul Newman camp. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he opened my eyes to the world of like really helping these kids, or like really making them, maybe not even helping so much as like giving these kids with chronic illnesses like a really great week at camp. Mm-hmm. And how important and sacred that is, right? Where it's like the only thing you care about is this kid having fun. And so he really changed my life. Like, I talk about this very lovingly, but like he made me more empathetic. He made me more critical of the world, of myself. And we were really, really close. And when we were working at camp together, I start seeing this woman, and you know, the love triangle started. He introduced me to her.
Okay.
But he was seeing someone at the time, and so he wasn't really available. And then I leave for Scotland, and the two of them, I guess, start hanging out. And it was one of those things where, like, the timeline's a little murky, but, like, he's always maintained, like, oh, like, you guys broke up and then we got together. But it always felt, like, too soon to me, mm-hmm. you know, where it was just like, and then, like, the main crux of it is he flies to Edinburgh for New Year's and tells me, hey, Kate and I are together, and we're not, like, sorry. We're not asking for your permission. Like, this is, you're going to have to deal with this. And it really did, one, it confirmed a suspicion I had, right? There's something about when you have this giant fear happening, mm-hmm. and then you're right about it, right. is this bizarre feeling.
It's not paranoid like, if it actually is happening to you.
Exactly, exactly. So there was a weird part of me that's like, well, I do get to be right, which is like not, it doesn't feel great, but there's a part of you that's like, oh, okay, like I'm not, you know, making stuff up. But it was the loss of like who I thought he was is like the big crux of it.
Mm. Who did you think he was versus who did he turn out to be?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think I really put him on a pedestal. I think I talk about this a lot in my show of really idolizing other people and kind of thinking that they're greater than I am and they're unattainable and that I should be chasing, you know, who they are, and being around these people makes me better. And so I really thought he was somebody that, given this situation, this really difficult situation, right? Like, a friendship love triangle thing is a tale as old as time.
Sure.
But I wish, you know, he really didn't show me any grace in that moment. He was just like, we're not asking for your permission, dude. Like, get over it.
Mm.
And that was such a shock to me because I loved him. And it was such a shock to me to see it laid bare in this way where he was like, I don't really care about you enough to do this gently.
Yeah.
And it's easier for me to put distance between you and I. It's easier to pretend our relationship is not as strong as it is. And that really hurt me. And it hurt me so much that I just kept talking about it on stage until it became this solo show. You know, like I needed to share.
So were Tim and Kate both in Scotland when they told you this information?
So the plan the whole fall was for Kate and Tim and a couple counselors to come visit me for New Year's.
Uh-huh.
And when Kate and I broke up around Thanksgiving, the first thing she said was like, I don't think I'm going to come to Edinburgh for New Year's. Like, it's not fair to you and I shouldn't go. But Tim was like, I'll still come. And so Tim came with a couple counselors and he told me in Edinburgh that New Year's week. And it was one of those things where he thought he was doing the right thing because he told it to my face. And I was like, you didn't tell me this in a way that cared about me at all. Like, because some friendships, and this has happened to me a lot after talking to people who've seen the show, where they're like, oh, my friend group, we went through this and we survived because we showed each other care. Like, I can think of a couple examples of that.
Yeah.
And I was always jealous of that. I was like, oh, you guys figured it out. We weren't able to.
You've talked about this kind of relying on other people to complete you, like throwing yourself into this friendship. Did you have kind of a diminished view of yourself growing up? How did you think about Gabe growing up?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I was a musical theater kid. I love musical theater. I was in a musical every year, at least one every year from fifth grade till senior year of college, actually all through college.
Wow.
And that was kind of my identity. And as like a straight guy in theater, you know, you just feel a little alienated, right? You feel a little bit like...
Especially musicals, yeah.
Especially musicals, yeah. And like I was a Sondheim nerd and that was my deal. And there was always a part of me that kind of felt like in either group, in the bro group or the musical group, that I didn't totally fit in that group. Like these people didn't totally... I always felt like defined by the thing I wasn't doing. So like in musicals, like Gabe's the bro, Gabe plays fantasy football, and with the bros... Gabe's the musical guy. Gabe loves Sondheim and Little Shop of Horrors. So it's this bizarre thing where you just kind of want to be defined by the thing that you're doing, but you don't feel that way. And I think that led to me having a little bit of a diminished view of who I was, even though deep down, I think secretly, I was like, I have these special talents. Like, I'm special, you know?
Yeah.
But I think the way I saw myself, the way it presented myself is... being anxious in different social situations and being attracted to a certain type of person, a certain type of magnanimous, smart, special person. I've always been really drawn to smart women, to smart friends. I'm always really attracted to that.
It's interesting. I've thought about this a lot because I was a theater kid too. And I think about how much the immediate gratification of a curtain call provides for somebody who might be a little insecure, might be a little at sea with themselves. Like you literally have, especially in an educational type setting, you literally have your peers applauding you as you stand there on stage. It's a hell of a drug.
Oh, it's incredible. The first time I was ever on stage, it was a fifth grade production of Bye Bye Birdie, and the kids operating the curtain are children. And so they made a mistake and they opened it like probably like 8 feet. And I'm sitting on stage on the kitchen. I'm Mr. McAfee. And I look out on the audience and like, clearly it's not my fault. There's just been a mistake. And I just kind of like made a face like, well, that's not supposed to happen. And it got a big laugh. And I was just like, I'm hooked. I didn't even say anything. I haven't said one line and I'm into this. Like, what? I'll do this forever.
The way you describe friendship and being attracted to people, and I saw some clips of you where you talk about how, you know, you like to go out and try to meet guys, meaning trying to make friends. It seems like a really blurry line, an intentionally blurry line between friendship and romance that you portray here.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons I was so drawn to talking about this on stage. And I think it's the reason why people keep showing up, thankfully, is that there's no real script for a friendship breakup. And romance, like the Killers have Mr. Brightside, and you can blast that at a club, and people are like, yeah, like I know that feeling that this girl I like is leaving with another guy. But when your guy friends break up, there's no script, and it's challenging, and there's not a vocabulary for it. And that isolation is really challenging to deal with. And so like I talk about it, like I go to parties, I try to meet guys, and even still, like I have people in my life who are like, Gabe, you can text me. I like you. Like text me. And even now I'm like, what am I gonna call them and talk about my financial problems? Like, I don't know. I just don't have that in me sometimes to reach out in ways that I know that I should.
Why not?
That's a really great question. I don't know. I'm working on it. Yeah. I'm really trying to get into a deeper level with that. I will say I've become a lot better since doing the show, and like the bros in my life who I talk about as being in some ways deficient, I've seen the show. I do call them more. And I think a phone call has been it's so funny, like I'm always complaining about my phone and my phone use or whatever, but if you use the phone and talk to somebody, it's probably the best use of it. Uh-huh. And that's gotten me out of a lot where it's like an hour phone call with someone is so, you could text 48 hours straight and it won't be as good as an hour phone call. No way. And so that, I think, has bailed me out a little bit. And Nick, who I talk about in my show, who's like my 30-year-old bro who like reacted somewhat poorly to my mom, the information that my mom got sick, he has like a tough moment in the show where I'm like disappointed in him. And he and I have gotten a lot closer, I think, since I've started talking about it and doing the show, where he's going through some family stuff or some medical stuff. And we just talk about that stuff, even just like 10% more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been really helpful. Sometimes it's like leaning on the people you already have as opposed to like trying to find new people.
Yeah.
Has been helpful for me.
What happened with Nick in regard to your mom?
So mom got sick and we were getting all these conflicting diagnoses. Like we weren't really sure what was going on with her, which was really stressful. And they're like, was it a stroke? Was it MS? Was it a bulging disc? Like what could it be? And periodically that week I'm texting the people in my life just like, hey, this is what's going on. Mom's in the hospital. And Nick sent me a message that was kind of like, he kind of like missed the mark. Like what I needed from him is to be like, hey man, how are you doing? And he was kind of just like, this is how I can fix the problem. Like, you should ask about this. You should do this. And I talk about this as like a problem that men have where we try to fix a problem instead of listening to it.
Uh-huh.
And the punchline is, I know that that's a problem that men have because I've dated women and you guys have told me. And that usually gets a big laugh from the women because they're like, we do say that all the time. We just want you to listen.
Coming up, when your best friend ends the friendship, what exactly do you do next? If you want to start a business and make your product or service available to everyone around the world, well, you can do that because internet and websites, I bet you've heard of websites. The internet is full of websites. How am I going to build a website, though, you think? I'm not a dang web designer. I'm not a dang web developer. I'm no dang webmaster. Well, good news, I'm here to tell you that you are a dang all those things. You can build a website, an e-commerce store, a web presence, and it's not that hard thanks to Squarespace. I did it, so therefore you can do it too. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. They have this new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint, where you can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. You can accept credit cards, PayPal, Apple Pay. You can upload video content, organize your video library, showcase your content on beautiful video pages. You can even add a paywall and sell access to your video library. Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/depresh to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Back with comedian Gabe Malika. I want to get back to, you talked about this breakup with your friend and your friend pairing up with your ex-girlfriend, but not the not too distantly ex-girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
What happened in the days and hours that followed this information? Because I think it gets to a lot of mental health, and we are the show that we are.
Yes, yes. This is really key because the two people I talked to the most in that time was my sister and my college therapist. And my college therapist is somebody I'm still very, very close to. He's come to see the show like 3 times. And I talk about him in the show because when Sondheim died, he called me on the phone.
Oh.
And that's how you know that you have a good therapist, because we hadn't talked in a while. And he was like, are you okay? Sondheim died. So yes, when that information, my sister remembers me, I don't remember this, but my sister remembers me calling her. And it was like 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning, Scotland time, and midnight in New York, and just kind of saying over and over again, like, I'm going to be okay. And I don't remember this phone call, but I mean, she remembers it very, very clearly. But I'm proud of myself that in retrospect, I did. Those are the two people that I reached out to, my sister and my therapist. Those feel like the right phone calls, mm-hmm. even if I was in shock, because it was also very dramatic. He told me at 4 in the morning, we had just gone to a casino. We had been drinking all day. Like, it was a mess. Now, drinking stuff like that, I don't do anymore. But at the time, it was, like, kind of part of my life. And so those are the people I reached out to. And I still have a lot of those emails with David, my therapist. And he was somebody that I really got to kind of process all of this with and talk through the language and the vocabulary of Tim doesn't think there's like a friendship code. And there is one. There is an obligation that you have to your friends, and realizing like, oh, that's what the objection. I don't have the objection to them falling in love. That would be crazy. Of course they can fall in love. We're on a planet in the sky. Like, people right. fall in love. It's fine. But what do you owe your friend if you want to continue that friendship? Mm-hmm. And being able to process that and then being able to internalize that and then be able to talk about it on stage. The talk about it on stage is kind of the last part. You know, you have to kind of be good with it in some way.
Yeah, that's another way to process it, I guess, is to get up on stage and process it. Might not be the most advisable or wise move, but it's one that a lot of people do.
Yes, and I definitely probably started a little too early wanting to talk about it on stage, but luckily I wasn't famous, and I'm still not. So, like, it was fine. Like, it was in a vacuum. Like, it was for no one. The anonymity was really powerful because you're like, you're just some guy. You can say whatever you want. Young comedians, like, I'm just like, oh my, like, when I talk to people who are like 23, 24 who want to do solo shows, I'm like, you're anonymous. That's really powerful. Mm. You can kind of say whatever you want. It's pretty great.
Right, right. Tell me about those times when you got up on stage in the immediate aftermath of this event. Like, what did audiences see on those occasions?
Yeah, I mean, I would just kind of say it very, very quickly. We're like, I do this. It started as like a quick joke. I'd be like, I do this because my best friend and my girlfriend fall in love, so I'm not afraid of you at all. Like, Tim and Kate got together, we're all going to be fine. And I would just say that, and now that's kind of what I do for 85 minutes as a show. Like, that same joke, really, uh-huh. or that same observation is what the show is. I just got better at the thing. It was also really nice to listen to, like, comedy podcasts. I remember at one point I heard Paul Scheer just offhandedly mm-hmm. be like, oh, yeah, like, when I was young, like, my best friend and my girlfriend fell in love. And for him, it, like, wasn't a thing that he was going to make art about. It was just, like, a detail in his life. And I was like, oh, it can be a detail in your life? It doesn't have to, like, define who you are? Like, that's so powerful. It was so innocuous that, oh, yeah, this thing happened to me one time. I was like, oh, cool. So when I got on stage, that also really helped, which is just, like, you can say it. No one's going to, like, be like, this guy's a loser. Like, everyone has, like, some sort of heartbreak. That's why we go to the arts, right, to share in that. So it was probably not well executed, but I was sharing it immediately.
it became an issue for everybody in the...
Yes, everybody needed to know. And I was in Scotland, right? So I was just like, who cares, right? I'm not on clubs on Long Island where I'm like, I know, like, the vibes of this place. It was like, I was a foreigner in a foreign land just being like, I'm so sad, I hate it here. And that was pretty funny.
Did it help?
Yeah, I think it did. And I maintain this during the pandemic also. The thing I missed about performing comedy is not the performing. It is the, I have a show tonight, and all day long now I have a purpose. So I'm going to write and drink coffee and walk around, and I have this thing at the end of the day that I'm going to be preparing for. And so that's why during the pandemic, even like Zoom show is obviously terrible, but when I had a Zoom show one night, I was like, oh, I'm so happy. Not because I love Zoom comedy, but because all day long now, I'm distracted from my own neuroses and I can just prepare something and I'm excited to share. Being excited to share, I think, is like the thing that gets me out of a lot of my self-doubt and my neuroses and my anxiety.
So when during this journey of, you know, living in Scotland, having this breakup with your friend and as you go through, when did you kind of come to this understanding that you don't actually have friends, you have bros?
So for a long time, I was telling this story, this Tim and Kate breakup story, and I was starting to get towards my late 20s, and I kind of kept thinking to myself, why am I still telling this story? Like, who cares? You were 22 years old. What difference does it make?
Right.
And when my mom got sick and I had like a real meltdown, which I describe in the show, like I throw my phone, I have this fit that I compare to Paul Dano in Little Miss Sunshine mm-hmm. when he like runs out of the car and screams. I like kind of have one of those moments. And when my mom got sick and like it felt like to me like the people in my life didn't know what to say and didn't know what to do, it was that real low point when I was like, oh, like I'm alone. I don't have friends. in that, it was an expression of a feeling. I don't necessarily feel that way all the time, but in the depths of it, I had the thought and the feeling, do I not have friends? And then once I had that feeling and I could explore it and write about it, then it kind of gave a lens to the friendship breakup story, where it was like, oh, this is why the friendship breakup story matters, because it felt like at one point in my life I did have those people, and then that imploded, and then my mom gets sick, and now it suddenly feels relevant again. It was like a lens within to see that big heartbreak.
Did you avoid making friends because you didn't want to get hurt again?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit to that, for sure. I think there's a it's safer to be at a distance, mm-hmm. right? And I'm a comedian, so I meet people all the time, constantly. Interesting, smart people, empathetic people. And I think there's a little bit like we're colleagues and we can be at arm's distance and we can see each other, you know, twice a season, and that's fine. And yeah, when you get hurt like that, it really does, it changes the way you look at friendship. And it made me revert back to being like, listen, the bros, in my early 20s, after the Tim breakup, I was like, listen, the bros are maybe not what Tim was, but they would never do that to me. Mm. There's comfort in that. They would rather die than make me feel bad. And so there's something about like, oh, these like dopey, doughy, like goofy idiots who I love dearly. Maybe they're not Tim. Maybe they're not going to ask to go hear me sing opera. But like, they would never hurt me like that. And they would certainly never be like, and we're not apologizing, like, get over it.
Yeah.
And so there's a comfort in that too, where it's like, yeah, they might not get to the 100% on the friendship scale like Tim felt like he was, but they're loyal and I'm loyal to them. And I think there's something really sacred about that.
What have been your experiences, if any, with therapy in trying to deal with these? The breakup, which you were still processing on stage many years later, and and your mom being sick, all these things that have happened. Did you go to therapy on some of these issues?
Yeah. So David, my therapist from college, I'm still very close to him.
Sure.
Yeah, so we'll talk a little bit now and then, and we just had we hadn't had like a formal session in a long time, and we did like a couple long sessions on the phone, because this show was going to be on This American Life, mm-hmm. and there was something about like, oh, 5 million people are going to hear this. How do you think about it? Because if you're not sure about it, it's hard to communicate to other people.
Right.
And so that was a situation where it was like, oh, I just need to talk through my thoughts. And the terrible irony is all the thoughts that we talked about in these like massively long sessions were not included in the story at all. They were just like, who cares about your personal journey? Which really made me laugh. But I was like, I'm glad I did the work anyway. Mm. You know, what's important is that I know how I feel. And I know that connecting with other people about the friendship breakup is in some ways more important than my relationship with Tim. In other ways, you know, I really tried in the last, I talk about this in the show also, but it's just like hard to find a good therapist. I think there's a reason I keep returning to David, even though he's a father and the director of a counseling center at a college and very busy, mm-hmm. where there's comfort in like, I know him already. I've known him for years. And even if it's not weekly maintenance, I can talk to him once a month and text a little bit, and he's there for me. He's somebody in my life who cares. I tried to find some therapists. I've probably went through 3 or 4 in the past year, and I just haven't found somebody who gels with me yet. I don't know quite what that issue was. One person, like, I knew immediately I wasn't good with, because she just kind of asked me generic questions and immediately was like, you have anxiety. And I was like, I don't think this is that helpful. Like, this is like throwing out a label to me within the first 40 minutes doesn't feel that great. Like, I would rather you just like ask me about my parents.
You're looking for something a little more Freudian.
Yeah, a little more Freudian, maybe a little more humanistic. Okay. Like, I'm like a pretty at least in college, I was like very humanistic. Now, maybe I could use some CBT, something more like goal oriented, uh-huh. or like checking boxes. I love to check things off a list. So maybe I'm growing into that a little bit more. Whereas a young person, I was like, I want to be a humanist. I want to do mushrooms and talk about, you know,
expansion of consciousness. Yeah.
Yes, yes. Where David is good. David is good for the practical stuff and like the big picture. Like, I'm going to walk around and do mushrooms.
Yeah. Do you have an anxiety disorder?
You know, that's a really great question. I resented her diagnosing me so quickly because I was like, no, I don't. Like, we don't, it doesn't have to be this way. I think, I will say this, I've had 3 panic attacks in my life and they've all been experiential. So they've not just been like, I'm on the subway and I start to panic and I can't stop. 2 were about like comedy career stuff, and one of them was when my mom got sick. And so I think I'm no more anxious than anyone else. You know, that evidence suggests to me that, like, oh, I'm anxious because, like, life is filled with anxiety. But then you talk to some people, it's like, I've never had a panic attack. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
And so I'm like, maybe I'm further on that spectrum than I think.
Well, again, and I talk about this all the time on this show, and to anybody who cares to listen, the elevation from feeling anxiety to an anxiety disorder mostly just means it's disruptive in your life. Like the carrying out the tasks and responsibilities and things you want to do, that gets interfered with by the anxiety. So mm-hmm. In that sense, has that been the case with you and anxiety?
Yeah. I mean, I have to make like a big decision in the next couple days, and I've been really putting it off.
Mm-hmm.
And the decisions about whether to continue doing the show potentially at a continued financial deficit, or do I take the risk and do that? And I'm supposed to like schedule these phone calls and make moves on it. And I just have kind of been at it like a 72-hour paralysis about making the choice. And so, yeah, it's affecting my ability to proceed, and like, people are counting on me and I just like haven't made the choice yet. And I haven't even done some of the work that would be required to make the choice. Like, I'm not even like making all the phone calls I need to make, the pre-work, you know? And so, yeah, I would say, how does it impact my daily function? Not necessarily, but it definitely, when big things come up, I just like it, like it's like a big flare up. And it's like, oh,
it gets
like,
in the way.
It gets in the way. The brakes come on, and I'm like, oh no. And yeah, so I honestly, like, when I was, there was a part of me that was like, this conversation, I was like, oh, this conversation is going to have me call David immediately after I talk to John, where I was like, oh no, I'm going to have to dive into this.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, you must do that a lot. You must have that effect on people.
Well, you know, I never with the person after the interview's over, so I don't know what phone calls they're making.
That's so funny.
But, yeah.
I had a feeling this is the direction we were headed, and I was like, oh, David's going to get a text.
Just ahead, Gabe's bro Nick becomes Gabe's friend Nick. We're back with comedian Gabe Malika from Solo, a show about friendship. Well, I mean, I'm really interested in the friendlessness or the alteration to your friendship. Like, tell me what happened with your friend Nick to allow this friendship to get deeper and give you more of that closeness that you craved. Was it just that he came to see the show?
So Nick comes all the time to the show,
uh-huh.
And a lot of times afterwards,
he's processing
like, oh my God,
his own thing about friendship.
He's exactly, and a lot of people. The show ends. There's a big reveal where I talk about Nick loves to rank the Adam Sandler movies. He's obsessed with them, and so at the end, like, we kind of give people a taste of what that list is like. And so a lot of times people come up to me and they're like, "Oh my God, has Nick seen the show? I want to talk to him about Adam Sandler." And I'm like, "He's right over there. Like, you can talk to him right now if you want." Nick and I have grown a lot in these last couple of years. I think in particular, the trust I had in him to be like, "Hey man, I'm going to talk about this thing on stage very publicly, this like not great moment between us." And Nick being not only okay with it, but supportive of being like, oh, like, you're going to talk about me in not a great light, and you're doing it because it will benefit the show, and it'll benefit people's understanding of you. And that is a trust thing that I am so grateful for. So that's really helped. The other thing is, like, Nick's gone through things in his own life in these past couple of years, some family stuff, some medical stuff, and we've just been a lot more open about that kind of thing. And I think there's something about hitting your early 30s where he's married and I'm not, but like the stressors become a little bit more real. It's no longer like he's a law student. Now there's like real family stuff going on. And listen, the majority of our conversations are still 80% like memes and, you know, fantasy football or whatever. Like, I don't like the day that the This American Life like thing was going to happen, like the biggest thing in my life ever, Nick texted me like, can you believe they're changing the Long Island Railroad schedule? And I was like, I can't believe this is what you're texting me today. Like, this is such the biggest day of my life. And you're texting me about the train schedule. That said, we really have started to set aside a little bit of time to talk about the adult stuff. And I am really, really proud of that. Mm-hmm. And Nick and Tim end up being this like kind of foil in my show where it's like Tim was the guy, like Nick doesn't care about musicals. He could give a shit, but Nick would never. Nick is just so he just loves me in a way that is feels so much more eternal, mm-hmm. you know, and not temporary. And so being able to talk about some medical stuff, that's been really, really good for us. And I'm proud to be a person in his life that he can turn to for stuff like that.
Do you love Nick like you love Tim?
I would say I have learned to love Nick so much more than I love Tim.
Really?
Because yeah,
you love Tim yeah. pretty hard.
I loved him as I thought Tim was. I was gonna. I thought Tim was like my
spend your life
soulmate.
With him.
With yeah, I really did. I really did. We were gonna ride out into the sunset.
Yeah.
And, Tim, listen. So Tim did the This American Life episode. He came to see the show. It was very dramatic. And that was a big deal because he did not have to come. He didn't have to fly across the country to see the show. And he does. And they asked him whether Tim cared about our friendship as much as I cared about our friendship. And Tim's answer was basically like, no. Like, Gabe cared about me more than I cared about him. And that's hard for me to hear. And I basically don't think he's telling the truth. I think he's preserving himself. That all that said, when he said it, like, it felt a little cruel to me. And Nick is imperfect, but he is not cruel. He is a kind-hearted, sweet person who wants everybody to get along and for life to be fun. And so in my early 20s, like, if you had asked me in college who you care about more, Tim or Nick, I would have said, oh, Nick's like a high school friend, but like Tim's the real deal. And now, like 10 years later, I'm like, listen, man, Tim was kind of a jerk. And sure, maybe I went and told everyone on the planet about our failed friendship, but Nick would never be a jerk to me and double down on it. He just wouldn't. In life, if you can find Nicks, I recommend them.
I keep thinking about if there was a male friendship breakup, like a hard breakup like you had, what hell that would play in a fantasy football league.
You know, John, I have a story for you.
Okay.
That I have never told publicly. I have never said this. It's such a good detail. It never made the show. Which is afterwards, Tim and I had this breakup, and like 2 years later, we played in the fantasy football championship game.
Oh, wow.
And what I know. And what happens in fantasy football is the day after the Sunday, there will be stat corrections. So they'll be like, ooh, actually, he got 8 yards, not six. So we have to change the point total.
Mm-hmm.
And Tim beat me by like 0.5.
Oh.
And then the next day they made a stat correction and they were like, actually, you win.
Oh.
and so I won on a technicality.
Wow.
And it felt very poetic.
Did you text him and say, and I'm not even sorry?
You know, we do text a little bit. That's the other thing that I wish Tim could laugh at himself a little bit more.
Mm.
Where, like, I make fun of myself constantly in the show. I'm a Sondheim nerd. I cried when Sondheim died. My therapist called me. Like, we're really, like, we're getting into, like, Gabe's a dork, and we can make fun of him. And Tim doesn't laugh at himself in the same way. Like, when Tim and Kate got together that next summer, we worked together at the camp again. And one of the first things I said to him was, oh, I should officiate your wedding, because the only place the place I belong in your relationship is standing between you, which I thought was really funny. And he was just like stone-faced, like wouldn't laugh. And I was like, if you can't laugh at this, like, this is funny. Like, you gotta...
That's a good line.
You gotta have a sense of humor. Yeah, I felt really proud of it. Yeah. And there's a part of me that thinks, had he laughed at that moment, I wouldn't have become a comedian. Like, had he just, like, given it up. But instead, I've had to chase this insane career because I'm a lunatic.
Wow. Are they still together, Kate and Tim?
So, they were together for a while, and they got engaged. And then they broke up. And I don't really talk about it very much in the show. I only mention it because afterwards everyone was running up to me and being like, are Tim and Kate still together? And I was like, if I don't close this loop, I'm just a bad storyteller. Mm-hmm. And when This American Life reached out, we had to get in touch with Kate to like fact check to make sure like we weren't like making all of this up.
Right.
And so I texted her and I was like, listen, dude, like, I'm sorry like that I brought your personal life into this. The show is not about you at all, but like, this is the deal. And Tim and Kate are both avid This American Life listeners.
Okay.
And so, like, we had Ira Glass call Tim, which was, like, a big deal. And when I told Kate, she responded, like, in a couple hours and was like, I did not expect this. I'm very proud of you. I love This American Life. I don't want to talk on audio, but I will talk to them. Mm. And her response when the episode came out, she was just so kind. I texted her again. I was like, listen, I'm really sorry to like air your dirty laundry in front of the whole world. Like, I'm really sorry. And she goes, I really appreciate that. I'm really proud of you. She said it again. She said, I'm really proud of you. And also, I probably won't listen to the episode. Mm. And I was like, wow, imagine having that kind of restraint because I do not.
you're probably hitting refresh on the browser to see when the episode will pop up.
Yeah, I've listened to it more times than I'm proud of.
Well, I mean, here's what strikes me from a perspective of our show and a perspective of mental health is that you maybe took an unusual step in dealing with the trauma of this breakup. You know, because this breakup was symbolized not just a loss of a friend, but a loss of part of yourself, because you put so much of yourself into a friendship. So, like, you know, it's not just losing somebody, it's losing somebody plus part of you. And then you process it and sharpen it and hone it, and in the meantime it sounds like you kind of grow up a lot, to the point where you can have these healthier friendships and healthier relationships. But it's funny that it's done through the constant polishing and carving of this trauma.
Yeah, they kind of run parallel to each other. And I think it is not a substitute, right? Like, becoming a solo show person is not a substitute for doing some work on yourself. But they are connected. They are certainly connected. And I think one of the beautiful things about my relationship with Nick is, like, do you idolize Nick? I'm like, no. Like, Nick's like a fucking guy. But... everyone's just a guy. Tim's just a guy. Kate's just a guy. All the relationships in the show from my early life that I'm really idolizing these people, they're just people. And having that relationship with Nick to just be like, yeah, I'm not intimidated to text Nick. I'm not like in awe of him. He's just he's my friend. That realization in the, in how normal he is in my life and how not on a pedestal he is really, that's been such a nice thing in my life, and the getting to see the bros every week and having them come, they come all the time to the show. That feels like such, I mean, I feel so loved. That's where I really feel loved. And they trust me to say, hey, I don't have friends, and they're all in the audience like, what's this guy talking about? We hang out all the time.
Yeah, it sounds like maybe you do have a bunch of friends.
Yeah. And by the end, I really do like close the loop on that and really give them their due.
So you need to make this decision. This show, this episode of this podcast is going to air after you make that decision. Can you keep in touch and let me know what decision you made?
Of course I will.
I don't know what this means for Gabe, for his mental health, or his financial health, or his friends, but Solo, a show about friendship, is still playing, extended since we taped that interview. It's at the Connolly Theater upstairs in New York City through November 18th. Then Gabe takes the show to Chicago at the Den Theater, December 20th through the 23rd. Next time on Depression Mode, Kevin Drew of the band Broken Social Scene, who knew what he was getting himself into.
As soon as I heard the title, I went, oh shit, I gotta do that. Depression Mode, are you kidding me? But I'm a very happy person, John. I need you to know that.
Okay.
And I need you to know that, yeah, I've thought about it. I've thought about leaving. And every time there's something that makes me stick around and it makes me stronger and it makes me understand more. It makes me understand why people leave. It makes me understand why people can't get out of bed. There's a power to feeling this way. There's a power to depression. I think it's really important that people feel it and get through it so that they can be a community and help others. It's super important.
Depression Mode exists because people donate to make it happen. If you have donated already, we really appreciate it. Thank you. You're getting the show out into the world where it can help people. If you haven't donated yet and you want the show to continue, we really need to hear from you. It's easy. Just go to MaximumFun.org/join. You find a level that works for you, and then you select Depression Mode from the list of shows. It's that easy. You're off to the races. You're helping the show, and you're helping your fellow human being, I think. Hey, you know what? The holidays are coming. It's a great time to shop at the Maximum Fun merchandise store. The merch store is at maxfunstore.com. You can find all sorts of Depression Mode items, all sorts of I'm glad you're here items. We've got shirts, we've got mugs, we've got Depression Mode sweatpants. Got to have the sweatpants. That's all at maxfunstore.com. Be sure to hit subscribe, give us 5 stars, write rave reviews. That helps us get out into the world even more and lets more people find out about the show. The 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline can be reached in the United States by calling or texting 988. Free, available 24/7. Our Instagram and Twitter are at DepreshPod. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies. A lot of good conversation happening over there. Some of it about the show, some of it about other stuff. Lots of it about just people helping each other out on the issue of mental health. Our Depression Mode newsletter is available on Substack. You can search that up. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at John Moe. Our electric mail address is depressionmode@maximumfun.org. Hi, credits listeners. If you put a frog in a pot of cold water on the stove and then turn up the heat, the frog will hop out when it gets too hot, because of course it will. I mean, come on. Depression Mode is made possible by your contributions. Our production team includes Raghu Manavan, Laura Swisher, Kevin Ferguson, Gabe Mara, and me. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out, building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
This is Mary from Maine, and I just wanted to say, I'm proud of you.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papuchik. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
Maximum Fun.
A worker-owned network
of artist-owned shows.
Supported
directly
by you.